Welcome to Coffee and Contemplation, a Stranger Things podcast. I'm Robin.
I'm Heidi.
And this is part two of our discussion of Chapter 9, The Piggyback. So, picking up right where we left off, this mind fight is back on.
Sick.
Elle hurls Vecna back away from Max and pins him to one of his own pillars, stalagmites, and so much happens at once after that. Joy saves Hopper, electrocuting the Demodog. So much catharsis from that.
Mm-hmm.
Max falls, Lucas catches her, the Demogorgon itself appears with more Demodogs in tow, and Hopper fires at it for reasons, maybe to slow it down a tad, even though it still does nothing else. As they run back to the pit, as planned, Murray does indeed rain fire from above. Love that for him. It roasts the critters below, and Vecna feels the effect too, along with the swarm of bats, which all drop, and the vines holding Nancy, Steve, and Robin captive, so they fall. And then we get our first little bit of interaction there, when Robin calls this a miracle, which I point that out only because of our previous discussion about Joyce being a miracle.
Yeah.
So this feels like an interesting follow-up to that, only this time Robin is indirectly referencing Eleven.
Mm-hmm.
And Nancy says not to waste said miracle, though. Thus, they move into phase four, flambé. In Russia, somehow, even after Murray's flambé, somehow the Demogorgon is still able to get back up. It hasn't taken crit damage.
This bitch is dramatic.
I mean, maybe it just passed one of its death saving throws. I don't know. But, like, And Hopper fires the rest of his ammo at it,
knowing that it's not going to do anything.
I mean, I get the instinct. It's yeah. Like, you know, that's something I'm trying to give them credit for. It's like, what is he not going to fire at it? And actually, to the VFX, you know, credits, you can actually see it where the bullets are hitting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You can see the impact, and you can see, like, its shoulder go back, which I think I only noticed this time.
Actually, just sitting here, this isn't in my notes. It occurs to me that this moment, this face-off, especially the way that the Demogorgon does just continue to get back up, actually, maybe it was indirectly, or maybe it was intentional, but it feels a little bit like the final fight between Aragorn and Lurtz at the end of Fellowship of the Ring in Amon Hen.
Yo.
The way that, like, when he stabs him and he just, like, leans into it, it suddenly makes me think of that.
Love that. I would not have thought of that on my own, but I love that, and I see it, and it makes me like that scene.
Yeah.
Kind of,
me
like,
too.
Significantly better. Yeah. Because, you know, I will never complain about Hop getting to kick some ass. Like, let's be real. Where the ass kicking is justified, at least.
Sure.
But that scene, I remember feeling like, I don't really know why we're doing this. I think we're just doing this just to do it. But, like, having that connection kind of sells me on it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, because then he has a sword. He looks down and sees the sword, which is the Conan sword. I don't really care. I'm glad it's meaningful for some people. I don't care. And I have to say, though, I stand corrected, because in our reactions episodes, I couldn't remember where the sword came from. And I think my recollection is that we all had a very, like, and then a sword randomly appears, and it's left over from the gladiator style fight.
Yeah.
But the thing I wondered this time about the sword, though, was, would it still be scalding hot? Like, I mean, I don't care that it isn't for dramatic effect, but I mean,
where's the light coming from? Kind of question.
Yeah. Like I said, it doesn't bother me. It's just, I found myself going, would he have actually, like, burned the hell out of his hand? Like, if this were real, I mean, again,
he might have. Yeah.
If this were real with him facing a Demogorgon. Yeah. But yeah, I'm just curious. Meanwhile, the Hawkins trio move into Vecna's attic, and they find him there in his trance, just as Dustin predicted. And I mean, we've been saying it all season, but there it is. And note, this is Robin and Steve's first time seeing him, and probably thinking, that's one ugly motherfucker right there.
Oh, yeah.
Because Nancy has seen him already, but they haven't. And in his mindscape, Elle does the slow walk up to him. Again, girl, just kill him.
Yeah. Yeah, like, this is not...
like, what?
This is not typical battle strategy for Elle.
Mm-mm.
I guess...
I mean, well, I will say, she doesn't... She has been known to, like, to show off a little.
True.
But under circumstances that are this dire, like, no.
Yeah, like, she wasn't showing, like, she wasn't showboating against the blob monster or against the Demogorgon the first time.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
The Demodog she did a little bit, but that's fine.
That's fine. And Vecna says to her here, "You and your friends think you've won, don't you? But this is only the beginning of the end. You have already lost." And out come the Molotov cocktails. It's great. I love it. And L replies, "No, you have. But I sincerely wish that she had just said, mouth breather." Like, I really, or something like that. Like, maybe not that specifically, but something like, because another thought I had was, oh, shut up. Like,
I know.
Like something cocky like that. We needed, we needed a little Han Solo right there.
Yeah.
I feel like is the vibe I'm getting. Like, but I mean, mouth breather would have been a really powerful thing for her to say, because after everything that we just saw with Mike and that connection all the way back to when they first met, mouth breather would have been a really interesting. And again, it's that same, no, you, again.
Yeah.
It's like, again? Really? So something that, I don't know, like, and this is a moment where it would have been a moment for humor, which is not normally something I opt for. But I was just like, that could have been a really, like, and that would have been very in character for her.
Yeah.
I think. But I mean, mostly I just found myself thinking that, man, shut up. Like, that.
Yes. Oh, much like, you know, like Falcon in Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
When that Hydra guy is making his, like, you know, boring ass speech about pain, and fucking just like, man, shut up.
And then we get that Running Up the Hill remix.
Yes.
This is my favorite remix of the season. I know, you know, Jenna raved about the Separate Ways remix. I do love that.
True.
This is my favorite. This sequence, you know, in spite of what follows it, in spite of the awful things we have seen and are going to see, these sequences are some of my favorites in all of Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
Like this whole thing, it's so epic. It has so much stand up and cheer energy, like punch the air, like, yeah, you know, and even Hopper fighting the Demogorgon, like, you know, like we were just saying, but mostly that Hawkins trio lighting up Vecna's ass, like, and Nancy stepping forward with that shotgun, girl. Yes.
Yeah.
And we said it, I think, when we saw it the first time, that look on her face, it's for Barb.
Yeah. And for Will, and for herself, and for this person that she is now realizing has terrorized her and her entire community and everybody that she loves and who has threatened her entire world. Nancy is, I mean, one of the things that I love about her is that she does not fuck around.
Mm-mm.
And this guy has been like the author of every evil thing that has befallen her for the past 3 years.
Yeah.
And like, of course she's going to take a shotgun to his face.
Well, I love the fact that this moment gets to be so powerful, both on a micro and macro level.
Mm-hmm.
You get both. You get the huge scope of it and this super specific personal thing that goes all the way back to season one.
Like, yeah.
I love how it gets to, it encompasses all of that. And also how this is a rare moment where this is such a strong example of plot and character in the exact same measure at the exact same time.
Yeah.
Because this is such a beautiful moment of payoff for Nancy's character development. Like how far she's come, how different, how much she's grown, and also how much this is so indicative of who she has always been.
Yeah.
It's great. And I love how the music drops out for the proper boom, you know, when she fires. Honestly, I had the thought while watching it, I was like, honestly, I'd love to see a team-up fight between her and Hopper next season.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she would make a really interesting deputy. I know it's not what she wants to do, but
yeah,
she wants to go be a journalist, but I don't know. I think she and Hopper would make a great team. I find, like, I want to say more about this sequence, but I don't have any, like, critical thought. It's just so great. I love it. It's a really interesting contrast of being such a high in this episode, which has so many lows.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Hawkins trio rushes down to where we saw Vecna land, he's disappeared.
So Henry is a human being, right? He's a superpowered human being. He's a very superpowered human being. But like, presumably, like his organs function in like a human way. Now, we already are like way, way past like the point of belief in any kind of like medical realism, but the fact that he survived being propelled into the Upside Down. But I feel both in terms of suspending disbelief and like narratively as a whole and just like in general, he should be dead. you and I talked about how we both really, really loved Dustin's theory that Vecna is the Mind Flayer's five-star general.
Mm-hmm. I still do.
I still really love that. Mm-hmm. And I wish that they had gone with that.
Okay.
Because, frankly, like, Vecna, he doesn't frighten me. He annoys the ever-living shit out of me.
Yep.
I recognize him as being very dangerous.
Yep.
Truly, I do. He is very, very dangerous. But I cannot help but be more frightened of the Mind Flayer than I am of Vecna. And part of that is probably because I still know less about the Mind Flayer than I do about Vecna.
We talked a little bit about this last time about how, like, I'm very conflicted about the idea of, I like the simplicity of that Vecna's all of it, that it was always him. But also, still, what is it?
Yeah.
We don't know what the Mind Flayer is. We don't know what it's the dust. It's the shadow. He made it form into a spider. But what is it?
Yeah.
So, no, I agree with you. It's the hugeness of it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes that finite detail away. And he was so much more interesting when he was just Henry Creel.
Yeah.
I think. And one. The idea of one by himself is a lot more interesting to me than VH1 plus Mind Flayer plus Demogorgon plus Meat Flayer. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So up to a certain point in, you know, the last year of, like, thinking about the ending and kind of being like, well, how would I have script doctored it? And what do I like? What do I don't like? That kind of thing. I have kind of been like, well, yes, some of the things that they are doing about with Vecna are clearly retrofitted. And I know that there's some kind of, like, speculation about maybe they were kind of, like, you know, leaving breadcrumbs throughout the whole series, and maybe they were and maybe they weren't. And I think that's, like, a perfectly legit and awesome, like, field for speculation.
Mm-hmm.
But my point with that is, yes, I do think that a lot of the things are retrofitted, but they kind of had to in order to, like, map out the fifth season. But now I kind of feel like they didn't, because they could have killed him and made Mind Flayer the big, 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 big bad. And I personally would have found that more compelling. But I do think this is kind of a, like, potatoes, potatoes kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of people, I've heard a lot of people talking about how they find Vecna incredibly compelling, and they really like that it was him that was controlling, you know, the kind of puppet mastering everything up to this point. So I'm kind of like, eh. He was more frightening to me in the first couple of episodes when he was just manipulating people's minds.
Less is more. Yep.
Yeah. I love Jamie Campbell Bauer, but the monologuing is what killed it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not his fault. It's not his performance's fault. They just gave him 6 pages of shit to say every 20 minutes. And I'm just like,
well, and it makes him feel like a very cliched villain, which is so interesting, because so much about the way that they lay the groundwork because I think you could make an argument that Jason is also a very cliched villain. You could say the same thing about Billy, human Billy in season two. But the reason that those two things work is because they're so grounded. I'm actually glad that they didn't kill him, because I think that if they had killed him here, there's still too much that's left unresolved in terms of now what? Whatever season five looks like. My hope is that in the absence of Russia and California and Nevada, if they are doing what they've said they're going to do, which they're going to laser focus in on Hawkins, that we're going to get more stuff like the Creel House.
Yeah.
We're going to lean in more to the lore, and with more time to focus strictly on that, I'm hoping that maybe we'll narrow the scope as well in terms of looking at Henry Creel specifically, rather than thinking of him as Vecna. That now it's going to be like, okay, we have a lot of the backstory. Now what do you do now that you have all this information?
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I get it. They didn't really have the opportunity, but it's like Hopper does what they weren't able to do in the Upside Down. They couldn't take his head off.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that by killing him, it would have been a lot of like, well, what is season five going to look like? And that might have been a really interesting question to leave it with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a feeling this is the part that probably a lot of people or a lot of listeners are looking for, have been, you know, waiting for us to get to, or maybe dreading. I don't know, because this is the section in which Dustin hobbles over to Eddie for his final moments while Erica gets into the attic just in time for Lucas to shout to her for help. and we get the briefest glimpse of her alarmed face before Max then dies in Lucas's arms with Elle there as well.
Yeah. My feelings about Eddie dying in this way haven't changed. Being honest and being very vulnerable, I found this incredibly triggering. And I don't think there's any lack of acknowledgement of that for folks talking about this death. Like, you know, from what I've seen on social media, I have seen a lot of people be very frank about it. But something that I have noticed over, I'm going to say the past 10 years in a lot of very popular media, and we're talking like, you know, pop culture media, is this idea of not even just redemption through death, because I think that's something different. You know, something like Anakin Skywalker in Return of the Jedi sacrificing himself to save Luke.
Mm-hmm.
I would call that redemption through death. This is not that. Even if Eddie as a character thinks that it is, because he very clearly from, you know, from what he says to Dustin, he thinks that that's what this is. I think any empathetic viewer understands that Eddie has nothing that he needs to be redeemed for. And so this is not redemption through death. This is glory through self-sacrifice. This is, frankly, in my opinion, glory through suicide. And I have seen this idea become more and more common, I guess, where they make this like big sacrifice and they die in order to stop the bomb or whatever at, you know, toward the end of the film. And every time I find it really, really upsetting. Every time I think about this scene and every time I think about Eddie, and even, you know, every time I think about Hopper, you know, being so willing and so like eager to sacrifice himself. And every time, frankly, I see usually men like hyping up stuff like this and talking about how good it is. And I'm not trying to like yuck their yum, and I'm not trying to like tell them about their mental health or anything like that.
Like rob them of their catharsis.
Yeah. And I mean, especially like based on what I'm about to say, like I'm not trying to tell them their mental health, but I want to say to these men, you are worth more alive than you are dead. The people who love you want you to be alive. They don't want you to, like, you do not have to protect and honor and cherish the people that you love by getting killed. Please do not, you have more worth than that. And like, we're talking about fiction, and fiction is not real life, but I really do see people in real life and hear the way they talk about themselves sometimes, and it reminds me of the way that Eddie talks about himself and the idea that these people would think that doing what Eddie did, knowing that they will die, would be the moral and the right thing to do is so upsetting to me. Not just because, hey, Eddie's a great character and I love Eddie, which is also true. You know, I don't see people like running out in front of traffic. Like, please don't get me wrong. But I see people, particularly men, particularly cisgender men, undervaluing themselves as human beings and thinking that the only way that they could like prove themselves somehow would be some like huge act of self-sacrifice. And it's not true. So yeah, that is why Eddie's death upsets me so much.
Generally speaking, this whole sequence, both Eddie and Max, I still particularly hate the use of Moby's "When It's Cold, I'd Like to Die." I get the thematic use of it as an example of the whole they, you know, the thing that the Duffers talked about. This is when they lose. This is when our heroes lose. You know, when they've always won before. The use of this music track, it's meant to feel sad.
Yeah.
But not in a, it doesn't hit me in the sad, like in a good way, kind of. That's not the reaction that I had. It upsets me more and more as time goes on, rather than, like with a lot of things this season, I've cooled off on a lot of things. A lot of things, it was like, I just needed some time to sit with it and process it. There's a feeling about it. I really, even in my notes, I have struggled to put this into words. it feels insulting, which is actually something you said in our reactions episodes. It makes me feel like I'm being taunted for mm-hmm. having cared. There's something about this music track because of the fact that the only other time it was used was when they found Will. And what that meant to me was, yes, it's been hard. Yes, this is hurtful. Yes, this has been a struggle. All of it, the whole season. But we get through it together.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this is the diametric opposite of running up that hill.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the reasons why it felt like such a sucker punch, because it felt like we were building to a very different conclusion. You know, like I saw an Instagram post recently. It was a meme. I think it was a meme. And it went by very quickly. And I can't credit wherever I saw it. But it was the, you know, when I hear this music in the trailer for season 5. And it was a bunch of crying emojis. And no offense to the person who did it. Why did we make that shift?
Mm-hmm.
It was triumph. Now it's tragedy. Yeah. And I really think that's the closest I'm going to be able to get to explaining it. It feels insulting. And it feels manipulative in a really, really backhanded way.
I think that's a lot of what I come back to with this sequence as well, both with Eddie and with Max, because I really, really, really fucking hate what they have done to Max. The whole fight sequence with Jason and with Lucas, and the fact that they couldn't get to Max in time to get the headphones on her. I love that.
That he breaks the tape.
And again, just as last year, I am not faulting the performances,
no.
which were on another level. But thematically, philosophically, in light of everything that the global community has gone through over the past couple of years, having a girl who goes through this experience that is very much a cipher for depression and trauma, and having that episode 4 experience where, just like I said, it is perfect on a narrative level and on a, I don't want to say allegorical level, but on a like symbolic level. Also, like I said, trauma and depression is not something that you just like snap your fingers or go through a course of treatment and then boom, you're healed. It is a monster that you have to fight over and over and over.
Yeah.
And having her know that and be willing to keep fighting and then just die. It's messy. I'm not even mad that the heroes lose in this episode, because of course they have to lose. You know, they can't triumph over everything. Even if they did end up flambeing Vecna, like there has to be some, you know, some remaining conflict or villain, or like there has to be some kind of fodder for season 5.
The gates of hell had to open up.
Right.
Someone had to die.
But they didn't have to do it like this. They didn't have to do Eddie like that.
Yeah.
They didn't have to do Max like that. And frankly, a good portion of the reason why I'm mad is because I do not believe for a second that she's going to stay dead. I just don't.
I had asked before we sat down to watch volume 2, if you knew if Eddie died. It was funny because actually Renee got up to leave the room. And I think that I was like, because I was on the fence about asking if, you know, because I knew that you had looked up who lives, who dies. And so she left the room like right before we were going to start. And I kind of leaned over and said, does Eddie die? And you just nodded. So I knew he wasn't going to make it out. I knew that before we even started chapter 8. But I think my expectation had been last year, and I never said anything about it because I was so wrong. But I think just intuitively what I expected was that Vecna was going to abandon Max and jump to Eddie instead, like he did with Nancy at mm-hmm. the end of chapter 7. And with no message this time, no music, not even his guitar, he has no way to fight. He would have no way to fight back. And Max might still be fatally wounded, but Eddie would have been the fourth victim, the fourth kill.
Yeah.
This would have entirely changed whatever season 5 has coming, I presume. But just with all of the theories out there about the reason why it had to be Max was so that she's in his subconsciousness so that they can bring her back because she still has a body. None of the other people do. Blah, blah, blah. But, you know, my other theory was more recently was it would have been interesting if the townspeople had like found him and killed him. Like if he had gone through the gate with Dustin and then somebody had in fact been watching Eddie's trailer. Mm-hmm. And then he gets swarmed and they kill him, you know, kill the beast kind of mentality. I feel like that would have been a lot harder to accomplish just purely from a plot mechanic standpoint without adding to the already very, very heavy bloat. But it would have been really self-aware and it would have felt like something we would have been building towards all season. Here, but the thing is, having either variation, either of those two, would change the chemistry of so much of this. Eddie is ripe for Vecna's manipulation. Like, it's almost hard to believe that he gets to this point without it.
Yeah.
Vecna feeding these same thoughts of cowardice, of abandoning Chrissy, would have taken this into a very different place. It would have been more lies, more twisted truths of Eddie's experience, making him a victim of these beliefs, not the show saying, yup, he didn't run away this time, he died a hero. And not indirectly agreeing with that decision on Eddie's part.
Yeah.
And if the townspeople had gotten him, then it would have been commentating on the danger of mob mentality. So, again, either one of those would have been, you know, would have been well set up throughout the season, just as much, if not more so, than this ending. Yeah. I think, I mean, even, like, taking all of, I think, our personal reactions out of it, this feels, I mean, yes, they've been seeding this whole, he's a coward, he feels like he ran. But like I said last episode, they already accomplished that with him not choosing to go back through the... You already did it! So to go this extra mile...
He did it twice.
It was... Yes, it was unnecessary.
He did not have to die. And
he did not have to die.
I very, very, very much agree with you that if either of those things have happened, if either Vecna had been like, killing Max is too much hassle, let me just get this other guy because he's right here and doesn't have this, you know, whole... support system, you know.
And he's got all this stuff right on the surface. Yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
And he's physically closer and, you know, blah, blah, blah. That certainly would have made me sad and upset because, like I said, I really love Eddie. I think he's an awesome character. I didn't want to see him go. And I still would have bitched about, like, them bringing in another new character just to kill him off.
Yep.
But it would not have been, it would not have been triggering in that way. Likewise, the town people killing him would have been very, very upsetting, but it would not have been upsetting in the same way.
I know, and kind of to something that you said, I know that there are some folks who disagree that this is a terrible ending. As a very specific example, I posted the article from Nerdist that I talked about in our reaction episode, and which I will link again in the show notes because I still agree with pretty much every word of it. And the title of the article is The Stranger Things Death Isn't Noble or Necessary, and it's by Rodham Rusak. And I posted it and said, like, I agree with every word of this. And I had someone argue quite verbosely with me in the Facebook comments, positing that the article was well written but wrong. That Eddie's death is an intentional tragedy and that this person personally got a lot of catharsis from it. And I guess I don't want to rob you of your catharsis either, but don't tell me that there aren't objective things that are very harmful about this decision.
Right.
Because there are.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad it doesn't rip up your insides, but I maintain that how much of the article gets right. And so I'm actually going to read a couple quotes from it. So, quote, "It falls into the harmful tradition of ultimately punishing othered characters for their otherness and denying them the life and catharsis they deserve. The show seems to think that Eddie's death enshrined him with something he didn't already have, glorifying it, like he finally found meaning when meaning was pouring out of him all along, leaves a very bad taste behind. Did Eddie ever really run away? No, not once. Eddie knew the score. Any othered person knows the score. If Eddie had stayed with Chrissy's body, there wouldn't have been any questions asked. He would have been arrested and sent to prison to rot. Is it really running away when survival is on the line? Is it really cowardice to feel scared and to hide when you know no one will believe you, and more so, that they would rather not? For those of us watching with whom Eddie's story rarely resonates, those real othered people living in a scary time where more and more mobs like the one in Hawkins are forming every day, where rights are being stripped from us, and evil becomes more emboldened. We don't want to see Eddie die a martyr. We want him to continue to survive. We want him to transcend. We want him, most of all, to get to live and to know with certainty that he's been brave all along."
Yep.
It makes me all the more sad of how much more right those words have continued to be. And I'm cherry picking through the article, but I didn't, it's only for brevity. Like, I'm not cutting anything out to, like, make my point clear. Like,
of course.
Read the article. It's fantastic. For me, and we'll get into this a little more later on, but it is the lack of follow through. And I mean, it is very much the presentation of everything we've already said, but it's kind of like, okay, justify its existence. And to me, the show never does. Mm-hmm. We get one eulogy from Dustin. That's it. And then on top of Max, like I don't have any critique to offer with Max. It's devastating. I hate it. It's so powerfully performed, as you said, by all three actors. Yeah, I mean, even if they bring both of these characters back, which it sounds more and more to me like they are going to,
mm-hmm.
this still hurts, and it always will. I don't feel like even if they bring them both back, it will make me feel any better about the decision in the first place. I know I just said, like, we'll justify its existence, but to me, bringing them back...
doesn't do that.
Yeah, not to me, anyway. I mean, the only thing that I'll say... about Mac, the part with Mac specifically, is that every time I get so caught up in the emotion of it all, which is by design, that when the clock chime does come in, you know, well, first you hear the ticking and then you get the chime. It is a shock and it's a gut punch when you realize what it means.
Yeah.
You're so distracted by just the personal character moments we've just experienced. Hawkins splitting open is bad, but somehow after the emotional weight of losing Eddie and Max, it almost seems secondary in terms of how hard it hits.
Yeah.
Which is... a good example of what I mean when I say that character is more powerful to me than plot in this show.
Mm-hmm. I mean, character is more powerful than plot to me as an audience in general.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's totally cool if people have, like, varying preferences when it comes to that. But with the gate, you know, opening, it's certainly, like... awful, but it's not awful in the way that watching Max die is awful. I mean, like, watching Jason get ripped in half, yeah, that's not awful. That's just fine.
Watching that now, it amazes me that I missed it.
I find that, like, and maybe this is a failure of empathy on my part, but I found that I couldn't care about anything else that was happening because I was so caught up in how I felt about Eddie's death and Max's impending death.
Yeah.
Now, I did later. Like when we were at the high school.
Mm-hmm. The pacing has changed considerably. Because, yeah, like Hawkins splits open, the crevices converge at the library and send a shockwave through the town. And we see, this was interesting, to climb out of the icky stuff, we see all four gates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Including the one where Fred died too. So does this mean that there's just been a huge ass gate in the middle of a Hawkins road and no one saw it? But before we get into all the reunions and whatnot, we get Elle in the Void bringing Max back to life by remembering their friendship. And I particularly like not just the use of, but the final placement of Max's previous line, "We make our own rules."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think some of this feels weird, but I'm not mad that Max is being revived.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, the California crew returns to Hawkins, seeing the mass exodus out of town. And that's when we get that. You know, a newscaster a la season 3 updating us with what happened, a death toll of 22, reporting that it's a doorway into hell.
There seems to be two types of people in Hawkins. One who has, like, even the mildest ability to look around them and be like, that creature is not found in nature. That creature is a 7-foot-tall monster with a flower of a head that's lined with teeth. That's weird, right? And then another set of people that is just like completely blind to everything that's happening. Ted, at the end, very like end, where he's like sitting in front of the TV, like watching the news report about, like, you know, reports of Satanism, which, like, I'll get into that. Like, he says something like sarcastic or like, you know, dismissive about like the accusations of like Satanism. But I'm like, bro, did you not see what happened to your town? Like, do you not see the like interdimensional chasms in your town with like the vines growing up like over the library? And like, did you not see that? What do you think is happening? Now, like Powell, when he walked in and saw Chrissy's body, he was like, this is above my pay grade.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you look at Chrissy's body and be like, yeah, a teenage kid did that?
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because you say that, but I find it hard to believe that the newscaster would say, oh, it's
Yeah.
It's Satan. Like, I thought it would have been flipped. Like, I thought it would have been that the newscaster's like, oh, it's a training exercise that's gone wrong. Like, because I find that usually in situations, like, even with the, you know, the satanic panic being a thing, I still feel like in terms of what's being reported, it would still be BS. Like, they try to find a scientific explanation for it. But then it would be Ted who's going, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Because that's kind of been his whole thing all season. The whole, like, we got a serial killer on the loose. Like, where's the FBI? Like,
yeah.
Surfer Boy Pizza Van arrives at the Wheeler house. The cut feels a little weird to me between them all standing and facing each other in slow motion to then both groups running at each other. There was something odd about that cut. So it feels like they might have been shot at two different points, you know, maybe due to the COVID lockdowns and whatnot. Mm. Or maybe it's just awkward. I don't know. Also, who are Robin and Steve talking to? Like, because they walk up and we don't see, then like we see them like walk up and then we see them walk back. But like,
yeah,
should they maybe have just hung back? And does anyone introduce Argyle to anyone?
Argyle needs no introduction.
This is fair. But Nancy and Jonathan, I will admit, I do like this reunion a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the way they embrace it. Feels very organic, which is not surprising. And just like everyone else, I do love Robin's little pat on Steve's back.
Yeah.
It's just really sweet and supportive. And I like the how much it indicates that, you know, how much more of, you know, his situation she's aware of.
Oh, yeah.
Than they've openly said at any point. I really like that.
Yeah. They're besties. And I love the way that it's handled. I love the way they bicker. I love the way they support each other. I love the way they see through each other's bullshit. Just the chemistry of their friendship is consistently a delight. That is like a season high for me.
At the hospital, second round of reunions. Lucas fills them in on Max's medical condition. A small note, Lucas has scars and evidence from his fight with Jason.
Wow.
And I did go back and look. I did try to see if we could see if Steve still had the scarring around his neck, but conveniently he's wearing higher collared, the collars of his shirts are high enough you can't quite see it. And I think they did that on purpose so they didn't have to put on this, which is okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
For some reason, I kept expecting Lucas to be reading, like, Fellowship of the Ring. Yeah, I don't know why I expected him to be reading Fellowship or, like, a Tolkien, you know, a Tolkien novel. Apart from knowing that, you know, he's nerdy and likes, you know, most people who like D&D grew up really liking Tolkien, even way before the Peter Jackson films. So
he's reading Stephen King's The Talisman.
Okay.
Yeah. Which a lot of people have like, what does it mean?
You know,
there's been a ton of that.
Yeah. Which
I leave that to other podcasters. Mm-hmm. That's not what we do here.
Yeah. And it's not a critique. I love that he's reading to her. Like, I don't care what he's reading to her. I love that he is reading to her. I think that's something that is so tender and so loving and so in keeping with his character and, you know, wanting a way to communicate with her and wanting a way to keep her mind active if there's some way that, you know, she can hear him. And we, you know, especially in recent years, have heard more and more that folks, that they can hear you.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that detail that he's reading to her.
I love that Erica is there.
Yeah.
I think she's there for Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I just think that's really wonderful.
Yeah, something that is true of both Lucas and Erica, I mean, of Erica more than Lucas, is that there are times that they have a tough exterior, but both of them, they're just so loving. You know, I keep coming back to that. Every time Lucas does something that is just inherently very loving and very, very empathetic, I'm like, yeah, like that's so Lucas. And they're both so brave and so like protective of the people that they care about. I love them both. And I love that we get to see more of Erica and to, you know, I think you made this point the last time we recorded. I love that we get to see more of their dynamic.
Yeah.
And not just the like super funny, super realistic. And I love it. Like them bickering and like, he's going to be buying me, you know, an entire with Duck Hunt, you know, like we get to see a lot of that. But then in this episode, we get to see like the depth of their bond. And I love that too.
Well, and that's something that you know, when Jenna and I talked about it in chapter 8, the fact that we get all those one-on-one scenes between a bunch of characters, we get Dustin and Eddie, we get Steve and Robin, and then we get Lucas and Erica, Nancy and Max. I think that it was interesting that we have that moment specifically, because I actually think this is the payoff for that. I mean, she doesn't really, I don't think she speaks in this scene, but the fact that we get that exchange between them where she's like, I came to your games because I was there to support you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all you did was warm the bench, but you know, then after that, she sees him holding Max in his arms and just sobbing like, you know, get help. And I mean, we only get that one quick shot of her with her eyes super wide and then she runs. But I'm like, that made an impact.
Yeah.
You know, they could have just not had Bria Ferguson on the call sheet that day. But I think it's important that we're seeing, like, no, she's there.
Yeah.
She's there for her brother. I think that's really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that Elle hugs Lucas because she knows she was there.
Yeah.
Ultimately, when we see the rest of what happens here later, when she's at the cabin and she comes back to this moment and we see that it's empty, there's nothing there. I thought that was, for me, the moment when I thought, oh no, no, she's gone. That felt so much like, honestly, it made me think of WandaVision when Wanda finally, spoilers for WandaVision, when she goes to see Vision's body, mm-hmm. you know, what's left of it. And she says, I can't feel you. And I feel like that hit really close to home for what happens for people when they're in that situation. And that's something I think I danced around it in our reactions episode, but I hope they bring Max back simply because I don't want to see Stranger Things tackle the issue of the theme, the question, the subject of, do we keep someone on life support?
Yeah.
I don't want that in this show. I don't trust them with that subject. You don't need that question in the show. So if that is the singular reason why I'm like, don't go down that road, just bring her back.
So, like, is her body brain dead, but her consciousness is still in Vecna? Is that what they're going to do?
I think that's what they're going to do.
And that's why, you know, Elle can't find her, is because she's not there.
Right.
Because her soul, her essence, her consciousness, you know, however you want to phrase that, is in Vecna somehow.
Because she's the only person who has a body that's still alive.
Yeah.
I think that's why they're specifying it that way.
Yeah.
But there's something so, like, I don't know, antiseptic about that. I don't like it. At the school, we see Steve, Robin, and Dustin drop off the donations and volunteer to help out, which leads Robin to her scene with Vicky and Dustin's scene with Wayne Munson. It just seems so obvious to me that Vicky likes Robin.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm here for it.
Yeah.
And I love the way Hawk goes, hi, yeah. at the beginning of the scene. Like, that's just a really nice line delivery. And then Dustin and Wayne, yep, hate it. I still love the performances from both Matarazzo and Stouffer, but, you know, they both kill it. But the actual eulogy that Dustin gives still sits really uncomfortably with me for all the same reasons it did in 2022.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, again, cite Rhoda Murasak's article.
Yeah, I mean, I think it says so much that, you know, you have this catastrophic earthquake in which 22 people died. You have all of these teens dead and these townspeople still do not have the critical thinking skills to look beyond Eddie as the culprit, so that Wayne has to continually replace the missing poster of Eddie because people keep defacing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even suggesting that I hate that narratively, because actually I don't. What I hate is the idea that Eddie was heroic because he sacrificed himself for these people. Because even with the plot staying as it is, those people are not who he did that for. He did that for Dustin. He did that for his friends. He did it for Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it in Chrissy's memory. Not because he cares, like, he...
And that's canonical, yeah. By the way, because he says it when he does his guitar solo.
Right.
And he's thinking about running from her death.
Right.
That was for her. But I mean, in terms of, like, the mechanics of the whole, he's drawing them away so that they won't go back to the, you know, that's part of just their personal plan. Like, mm-hmm. It would have... Because these are the people that have shown Eddie compassion and love and acceptance. And Chrissy showed him kindness.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And I like that. I like that. In exactly the same way that I don't blame Eddie for feeling as though he ran when Chrissy died, even though I don't feel that he, you know, air quotes, ran, or that he, like, I don't think he displayed cowardice, because as we've discussed, there's nothing that he could have done. And I think that's what cowardice means. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't blame Dustin for feeling this way about Eddie. Like, I wish everybody else could have known Eddie for who he was, because then they would have loved him as much as I did. I don't blame Dustin for that being his, like, immediate reaction in the first throes of his grief. Frankly, like, it keeps, what I keep coming back to is I blame the show for killing Eddie the way they did.
I don't disagree with you. I think it bothers me because because that's all he says. To me, it feels tonally out of place with Dustin's characterization. I think that Dustin would have leaned on, he saved my life. He saved my friends' lives. Eddie cared about us. That feels more like the kind of person that we've known Dustin to be. And it's like, okay, if you want to include this part of it, okay, fine. But not including the rest of it, I don't know. And especially because of the whole, like, the way, I mean, we talked about it in chapter one, the whole, we are nerds and freaks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that kind of radical self-acceptance that Dustin had from the beginning, I kind of feel like Dustin would have been aware of Eddie's otherness, and that would have been another moment for them to have commented on it. And they didn't in season five. I want to see him wrestling with grief. I want to see him wrestling with being angry. I want to see him being, you know, just really, really struggling with it and not knowing, you know, dealing with something he's never had to deal with before.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that anger being like, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Because I think that is such a human reaction. I still like Jenna's idea that she mentioned in our reaction episode that, you know, having Nancy be a part of this interaction somehow would have been another, like, leg up for it, because, you know, that, I mean, again, that gets complicated given that she goes to the cabin with the buyers and Argyle, but still, that would have been a nice bookend, and it would have built in a reason for Wayne to trust what he's being told. And I don't buy the whole, like, she can't be there because it has to be the original group on the hillside, because neither Dustin nor Lucas are there. And also, this might have been a nice moment, you know, even if you don't change any of the dialogue, this might have been a nice moment to add a flashback, even a quick cutaway to she, Steve, and Robin finding Dustin and Eddie. You know, we wouldn't need any dialogue. We would just get quick flashes of, like, what that looked like. Because something we went right by was the fact that the Hawkins trio, they go back into the Creel House when they hear the chime go off, and Nancy goes, Max. And that's it. But, like, other than that, we get no indication of what their reactions are. And some of that, you know, the lack of all this stuff that we're kind of getting at is part of the fact that the cast, the roster of characters, it has snowballed. They have so many.
Yeah.
And I can even admit that there really is no way to accomplish all of this. So that's why, to some degree, I'm saying, like, the deaths themselves aside, there's a lot to me riding on season five, and not strictly in the sense of, oh, they have all these things to wrap up and what's the adventure going to be? I mean, there's that. There is that too. But there's also, like, you have a mess to clean up with this stuff.
You have some splaining to do.
At Hop's cabin, the group there start cleaning up to hide Supergirl, as Argyle says. Costume note. Why are some of them in new clothes and some aren't? I don't know what this is for me with this show, but, like, me noticing, like, when people don't get to wear new clothes. Like, it would have been nice to have, you know, for Eleven to get, you know, a new costume for the final scenes of the season. Like, there's a lot, I don't know, like, it's just weird. And Argyle goes off to gather mushrooms, naturally, while Nancy and Jonathan board up the window. And echoing what I said previously, this mirrors that shot with Steve from mid-season with the Creel House.
Mm-hmm.
The framing, the angles, inverting the action, putting boards up instead of taking them down. I think it's interesting. I don't think it's you know, coincidental. I think that's done purposefully. And she and Jonathan talk about their relationship and whether or not they're okay, even if they don't fully tell the truth. And when Jonathan says, "Who'd have been in charge, Steve?" her response about him having grown up would probably, like, in Jonathan's defense, that would probably land weirdly for him, because he hasn't really been around Steve any more than she has in the past 2 years, and she offers no context for why she believes that.
Yeah.
So I feel like Nancy would have said something. Like, mm-hmm. that's there just to fuel the love triangle. Mike and Will review what happened to Elle and the fact that Will can still feel Vecna. I love the detail that Mike and Will move the cushions around to sit on the tipped over couch rather than pick it the right way up. It is mm-hmm. such a kid thing to do. Like, yeah. I liked that detail a lot. It amused me a lot more than it probably should have. But like, joking aside, I really love this moment between them. You know, these kinds of moments are some of the strongest between them.
Yeah.
And yeah, this was the first time I wondered about the theories on whether Will and Juan are related.
Mm.
You know, they have a connection. And I still, you know, kind of to some of the things you were speaking about, you know, of the whole, how much of the stuff we've seen along the way, I still maintain, I think Will has been a target. I don't know why, but I still don't think it was always Elle. I think there is some, and especially, so there was also the recent Variety article that came out titled Noah Schnapp's Coming Out Journey, The Stranger Things Star Would Still Be Closeted If Not for Will Byers Being Gay. It's a great article. Read it. Yet another link for the show notes. But I bring it up here because even though the article is very much largely not about like season five, there is a note at the end that includes a brief mention of the fifth season where the Duffers say, quote, "Will take center stage again in five," says Ross Duffer. This emotional arc for him is what we feel is going to hopefully tie the whole series together. Will used to be the young one, the introverted one, the one that's being protected. So part of his journey, it's not just sexuality, it's Will's coming into his own as a young man," end quote. So it kind of gives me hope for some of the things I've been hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
On a positive note, I very much look forward to seeing what that means, so long as it doesn't mean his death.
Mm.
The spooky music when the government car pulls up, as if we don't know it's Hopper.
I know.
Before we get the reunion with the adults, though, that is when we go back to Elle and remembering Max and, you know, finding the Coke bottle and seeing that Max is not in the void.
Yes.
But then we get Hop and Elle's reunion. And she says, "I never stopped believing," which I'm kind of like, okay, when?
Yeah.
That felt unearned to me. I think this kind of reunion is still just a little too personal for me. Mm. And based on my experience, I think it just doesn't resonate in a way that, yeah, I don't like it. I think that's just a personal thing. I might have flipped the reunions with Hop and Joyce, that Joyce comes in to the house and that they kind of prepare her for the fact that Hopper is still alive.
Mm. I think it's fine. I think the thing that makes me sad is that it's a thing that has to be got out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, but such as it is, like, I didn't have a bad reaction to it.
Hopper tips his hat to Stinson and then we get his reunion with Mike. I liked seeing Stinson,
mm-hmm.
not gonna lie. And then Will feels the sensation across his neck and we get the Stranger Things theme kicking in just as the clouds darken and the particles start to fall and we see all of our characters react across Hawkins, ending on that final shot on the hillside overlooking the town. And dude, the grass is rotting and the sky is straight out of the upside down. Like,
yeah. Plus the helicopters in the distance. Like, it is proper, like, dystopian, like, supernatural disaster movie type stuff. Like, it's wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really have a lot to say about the final shot. I remember thinking, like, This is the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like this is the final moment. I mean, in 2022, I was a little salty about the fact that I was like, it's straight out of Empire Strikes Back. But again, I take some of the heat out of that statement. It's clearly inspired by that. But mm-hmm. what they're looking at, as you said, like in Empire, they're looking at space. They're not looking at a disaster scene. They're thinking about it. And we do have our Han Solo and Carbonite stand in with Max, but it's a very different view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I want to just acknowledge that. But I remember that they said leading up to the release of season four that, like, yeah, this season doesn't end like all nicely wrapped up. I think we talked about that in our volume one reactions.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't feel like incomplete in the way that I think I was expecting more of a cliffhanger. based on those statements. But it's true. Like, they didn't wrap it all up. Although, yeah. I mean, but I don't know. I would argue that, like, there's a lot of stuff that has kind of been left open-ended before. Certainly mm-hmm. season one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they even kind of meta joke about it with the Proud Princess and the, you know,
mm-hmm.
the egg that was cracked and, you know, Hopper getting into this strange vehicle and the Eggos. And so this didn't feel as, like, wildly different as I think we were led to believe.
Yeah.
That's not, and I'm not saying, like, that I'm, like, criticizing that. I'm just saying, like, that was just my reaction to it. It's not a bad thing. It just is.
Mm-hmm.
So normally this would shift us into the final thoughts segment, but our next episode will be something of one big final thoughts conversation. We're going to do a post-season 4 roundtable discussion between the two of us, Jenna and Steve. So we'll hold off on that. But specific to this one episode, and we've kind of chatted a little bit about it already, how does this feel as an ending point, just kind of sitting in the aftermath of this finale compared to a year ago for you?
Apart from Max and Eddie, I think I like it a lot better now than I did a year ago. I have had time to percolate on a whole bunch of stuff. It's not all coming at me for the first time. I mean, it was definitely like information overload, sensory overload the first time. And, you know, things make a little bit more sense. And, you know, I've done like a rewatch, so I'm sure I like picked up on things I missed the first time. This time last year, I hesitated to agree to record these episodes with you.
More than just you didn't want to record the episodes, I think you were upset to the point where you didn't want to really be on the pod at all. Like, even anything tangentially related to Stranger Things, you were like, I can't be part of talking about this show.
I knew, like, I did the reaction episodes with you,
mm-hmm.
but I do remember saying, I think I'm going to tap out because I was just too upset. And I don't feel that way anymore. I do feel like I'm able to talk about it, you know, in a way that I don't mind my words being made public.
Sure.
So I think that's the big difference. Like, I've mellowed enough that I feel like I can talk about it, but the things that upset me, like really like upset me haven't changed. And a couple of the things that I was just like, eh, whatever, I feel a bit more positively towards, and things I liked, like the flambeing of Vecna, I still like just as much. So overall, I feel a bit more charitable. And I'm happy that, you know, I was able to come back because I do enjoy doing this. And, you know, I would much rather feel in a place like, yeah, let's talk about it versus rage quitting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I had a much stronger reaction to season 4, to the end of season 4, than I think I let on at any other point. I was actually right there with you. To echo something you said a year ago, I'm tired of death.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, for me, it's even like bigger and more abstract than that. I came to Stranger Things for a very different experience than what I feel like they have. Season 3 and 4 have largely changed a lot of, I have said this before, that they've changed a lot of the little things about what the takeaways end up being. Season 1 and season 2, and I should probably save this for next episode, but I'm going to say it here because it feels pertinent to what we're talking about. And as far as like the end of this episode, season 1 and season 2 felt thematically very much about, like, it's about getting through together. And how do we brace the tragedies together? Jenna said it in our reactions episodes that so much of these experiences are personal, are community tragedies. They're community losses. And we're not seeing community healing. We're seeing further community isolation and separation. And even from our core characters. Like, and I could see that there might be an argument for, but that's kind of the point. And maybe that is reflective of some of the things that we went through between 2020 and 2022. But I wish if that was the case that they had committed to it stronger, because what ended up happening is that I got to the end of season 4 and this ending really affected I mean, it has a very severe ripple effect. It has taken me, even now in 2023, it has taken me a lot of effort to not let this impact and kind of taint the rest of the season. Mm-hmm. And some of that is easy to do because there is so much, because I do think in general, like up until the ending, my vibe, the impression I got last year was that I had enjoyed more of season four than you did, just overall. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Mm. Like, I had really, really been on board. I was like, yes, it was bloated, but I had really loved the tone setting they did at the beginning. But this ending, I mean, I made the decision. I was like, I am not going to binge season five. So I'm going to take even longer with season five's, you know, podcast episodes that I'm sticking with. I'm not going to binge it. And I'm going to look up spoilers, because if I felt this way about Eddie, mm-hmm. especially since we're going into the finale of, you know, the series finale, I don't think anybody is safe. And I'm going to need to know who dies in mm-hmm. season five before I go in. I'm going to need to know. Now, granted, I knew about Eddie and it still didn't change how I felt about the way they handled it. But just some sort of heads up will be, I think, necessary for me. So I had actually considered not doing season four at all. I had considered not doing the podcast anymore and being like, I don't think this had been such a source of fun for me. You know, as much as I bitch and complain about certain things, ultimately I have still loved the show mm-hmm. and I still do. But there was a moment there when I was like, this isn't fun anymore. And I don't as maudlin as this might sound, I didn't necessarily feel safe with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really upsetting thought to have. And it shocked me that this bit at the end was able to take me to that place. And that was why I knew I needed time. And I was like, I'm not fully ready to give up on the podcast completely. I want to stay in the loop, but I don't, I'm not in a place to be able to talk about this season yet. So it's been a really interesting journey to come back to it. Part of my motivation, though, for also not closing the book on it, as it were, was because this is chapter 4 of 5.
Right.
And, you know, we don't know what season 5 will hold. I am very interested to have some of these tougher conversations once we have the whole narrative. But all of that said, I'm really glad that I didn't abandon it. I got a lot out of doing this season. And so with that in mind, I am really looking forward to the next episode that we're going to do.
Yeah, same.
You know, in spite of what I said about the final shot and not feeling like, oh, this is a radically different ending, the radically different stuff was the deaths.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it really did. It left it still does leave a very sour taste.
Yeah.
And that makes me sad. It makes me sad that this is the last we got. Mm-hmm. You know, of the season, of the story. So I know it's going to be a while, but I'm also one of those people that I'm willing to wait longer for a better show.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, that's not even getting into the whole conversation of how we stand with the strikes and, mm-hmm. and whatnot. But just even if the strikes weren't happening and if none of that was an issue, then when they were saying it's going to be another 2 years, it's mm-hmm. like, if that's take all the time you need.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember there was, and this was in relation to video games, but it's the same exact concept. There was a viral post that was going around, and I don't remember which social media it started on, but it ended up on all of them, that went something to the effect of, like, I want fewer games with longer production times made by people who get paid more to do less, and I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is the energy for very much for both of us.
Yeah, absolutely. So that feels like a weird place to leave it, but I think that's going to conclude our contemplation on chapter 9, The Piggyback. But that's not it for season 4. As I said, we'll be back soon. Exact date to be determined, so watch our socials for that. With a roundtable discussion reviewing the whole of season 4, the state of the series, hopes, fears, expectations for season 5, more than what we've already gotten into, and a few other fun little surprises. Like I said, watch our socials for the details on when that episode will drop. But until then, as always, thank you for listening. The aforementioned socials include TikTok and Instagram, links for which are in the show notes, as always. And if you're a fan of our pod, consider rating and reviewing us. Coffee and Contemplation is available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, over and out. This is part two of two. I'm not splitting this into three, don't worry. And if I have to take that out, so be it. We'll see. I don't think we'll this will need to be three episodes.
I have an itemized list of grievances. I don't.